The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, September 7th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean of the University of California Berkeley Law School, on his book, Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights, as well as, of course, the most recent developments at the Supreme Court. We are off today. It is the Jewish holiday, Rosh Hashanah, and makes this... that much more appropriate for those of you who celebrate. Happy New Year. For those of you who don't, still have a new interview for you today with Professor Chemerinsky, or I should say Dean Chemerinsky, on both his book and, of course, the recent ruling by the Supreme Court regarding the abortion ban in Texas, and frankly, the use of the shadow docket and what that speaks to, what's happening. And of course, the California recall, I guess, on some level. So listen to this interview. We will be back live tomorrow. Enjoy. We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Erwin Chemerinsky. He is the dean of the University of California Berkeley Law School, and his most recent book is Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights. Welcome, I think, back to the program, is safe to say. It's been a couple of times over the years.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me back.
This is a fascinating history of the relationship between policing and the Supreme Court in this country. I don't think I realized how much the Supreme Court, I guess I shouldn't have been terribly surprised, but how much the Supreme Court has over the course of certainly over the 20th century, shifted in at different times in terms of where our constitutional rights lie relative to the police, and how much they've been responsible for tactics that the police have used that we all really bemoan. But let's start. Let's just start in. I guess I mean really what we're talking about is Reconstruction on some level. The 14th Amendment. There was no. Policing as a sort of a broad proposition didn't quite exist until that time, did it? Or tell us.
Organized police forces, as we know them today, didn't come about until after the Civil War. Now, there was always the town sheriff or the town marshal, but if they needed a group of people to help, say, find and arrest somebody, they would gather a posse together to do it. The closest you find anything like an organized police force early in American history were the slave patrols that existed in the South to round up escaped slaves and return them to the owners.
And so in some respects, and I, you know, this audience knows that I've gotten sort of somewhat obsessed over the years with Reconstruction and really the implications of the 14th Amendment. I mean, I contend that era was really sort of the founding of the United States as we know it today. And so it makes sense, on some level, that the 14th Amendment becomes central, as it has in many other aspects of our society. But it becomes central in the context of policing because the 14th Amendment was to the extent that they were willing to go, empower Black Americans, and would theoretically restrict or implicate the power of those organized, I guess, slave patrols.
You're right, of course, that the 14th Amendment was, through its Equal Protection Clause, meant to protect those of African descent. But the 14th Amendment is important in this story in another way as well. The Bill of Rights has many provisions that were meant to control the police. The Fourth Amendment that limits the ability of the police to stop, arrest, search people. The Fifth Amendment that limits how police can question because of the privilege against self-incrimination. The Due Process Clause that limits how the police can do identifications like lineups. None of those provisions applied to state and local governments when the Constitution was written. It was only through the 14th Amendment and only in the 20th century that those provisions got applied to the states. Isn't it astounding that prior to 1932, a state could try somebody in state court for a capital crime, have the person convicted and sentenced to death without the person having a right to a lawyer?
It's stunning. And but so how, I mean, why was that the case? I mean, why does the early amendments not apply to the states, but the 14th Amendment does? Or explain to us how, and then the why.
Sure. It was thought that the Bill of Rights was meant just to constrain the federal government. Some of that was about states' rights, because to apply the Bill of Rights to the states limits what the states can do. The 14th Amendment changes the perspective of the relationship between the federal government and the states. The 14th Amendment is about limiting what state governments can do. It says states can't deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. States can't deny equal protection of the law. States can't take away the privileged immunities of citizenship. And this was the provision of the Constitution that dramatically altered the relationship of the federal government to the states. And it's not surprising. It's the 14th Amendment that was then seen as the basis and was the basis for applying the Bill of Rights to the states.
And so the 14th Amendment had a sort of like a structural aspect to it that the other amendments didn't have, and really was the one that sort of the delivery mechanism for the protections that those other amendments offered.
Very much so. And one by one over the course of the 20th century, but really especially in the 1960s under the Warren Court, the Supreme Court said the Bill of Rights applied to the states. Again, you know, it's stunning. It wasn't until 1925 that freedom of speech under the First Amendment applied to state and local governments. It wasn't until 1963 in Gideon versus Wainwright that the Supreme Court said that the right to counsel has to be observed in state court with as a possible prison sentence.
I think people would find that fascinating at this point. And so it's not until 53 when we do get the Warren Court, I guess, at that point, that the 14th Amendment is interpreted that way. Or, I mean, what happens prior to 53 from that period of time from Reconstruction when the 14th Amendment is ratified and through that era? Are we building towards something during that time, or is it just no Supreme Court at that point is touching it?
With regard to the application of the Bill of Rights to states, we're slowly building to something. 1925, freedom of speech is applied to the states. 1932, the right to counsel in capital cases applied to the states. 1940, free exercise of religion is applied to the states. 1947, the Establishment Clause applied to the states. But all of that grows exponentially, especially in the 1960s under the Warren Court, when it applies virtually all of the Bill of Rights to the states. And what it means to say applies is, if it doesn't apply to the states, then states can infringe freedom of speech or convict people without counsel. They don't have to pay any attention to the Bill of Rights, before these provisions are applied to them.
And we should say the Warren Court is really sort of the, well, I guess it depends on your perspective, but from the perspective of the writer, probably, you know, the hero of this saga. There may be others that have, you know, a slightly different perspective on that. But so, I mean, for the sake of people, for people who don't sort of, you know, fully appreciate, and this is going to be helpful, I think, when we go to present day and we start to sort of assess what the current Supreme Court is doing. It's almost in like the opposite direction, if you will. But when we talk about that era prior to the Warren Court, and then I do want to spend a little time on how the Warren Court did this. But what is happening during that era when only one by one certain rights that we have that prior to that were simply a protection, if you will, or a constraint on the federal government, start to get applied to state governments? Like, what is the general, I guess, you know, within the context of the broad legal institution, what is the understanding of this? And is there a concerted effort to provide these protections? I mean, how does that work? I mean, you know, and who are some of the players that are pushing in which direction?
There's a huge debate in the 1930s and 40s and 50s as to how much of the Bill of Rights should be applied to state and local governments. On one side, you had justices like Frankfurter and Cardozo who didn't want to apply the Bill of Rights to the states. So as recently as 1942, the Supreme Court said, there's no right to counsel in non-capital cases in state court. And their reasoning was, we shouldn't be constraining the choices of state governments. We should be respecting states' rights. On the other hand, you had justices like Hugo Black and William Douglas, who said the Bill of Rights are the fundamental liberties that every person possesses, and we shouldn't allow states to interfere with them. And ultimately, Black and Douglas win that debate, and one by one, almost every provision of the Bill of Rights gets applied to the states.
And so when we're talking about someone like Frankfurter, I mean, like what was the, I mean, I hear the rationale that was the rationale simply like this was never intended to protect citizens from other entities? I mean, I don't know that I fully understand the logic there, that there's something fundamentally different between a federal government and a state government, except for maybe in that era, there was a sense of like, you know, we're a confederacy as opposed to a federation. Like, I don't understand how one can think that you have a certain sort of right that does that interpretation by Frankfurter suggest that he believed these were not rights that people had and were, but rather these were, this was simply a limitation on the federal government.
Exactly. They believed that the original understanding was that these were limits on federal power, not statement of rights that all individuals possess. And they believed that state constitutions would provide protection against state and local governments, and the Bill of Rights was necessary for protection against the federal government. Well, we came to realize that state constitutions weren't providing protection. Also, I think that there's came to be much less concern about protecting states and state autonomy for the sake of its own protection. And I think that that made the court much more willing to apply the Bill of Rights to the states.
If you believed that the Constitution was only something that was written not as an expression of the rights of people who are citizens, but rather a limitation of this one specific entity, why wouldn't you think that states could simply protect these people and is subservient to the federal government? In other words, the federal government says like, okay, you don't have a right to counsel. We're not going to provide that for you. And the state could say, well, we override it. The federal government just, you want to come in and do a case? If it's going to happen in the case, you know, in the state of Connecticut, they need to have counsel.
The states always can provide more rights than the U.S. Constitution. And as I describe in the book, there are many instances where the Supreme Court has refused to use the U.S. Constitution to control the police, but state Supreme Courts have interpreted state constitutions to do so. But to go back to where we started, the original thinking was the Bill of Rights would protect people from the federal government, state constitutions protect people from state governments. Now, the reason this matters in terms of policing is there was no federal policing in the 19th century. Not until Prohibition did we start developing things like the FBI. Policing was done at the state and local level. And if the Bill of Rights didn't apply to state and local governments, then there wouldn't be occasion for the Supreme Court to deal with policing issues. And that's why for over 100 years of American history, you don't have Supreme Court decisions about limits on the police with regard to the Fourth Amendment search and seizure, or limits on the police from the Fifth Amendment in terms of police questioning.
That's interesting, and it almost dovetails into what we saw this week coming out of Texas, or at least it raises some of those questions. All right, but sticking with this timeline, and then in 1953, we have the Warren Court, and the Warren Court was only around for less than a decade, but it did a lot of work in terms of providing people protection from the states and from excesses of law enforcement.
It's a little bit more complicated in that the Warren Court began in 1953 and continued until 1969.
Oh, okay.
But it was really only in 1962 when Felix Frankfurter died and was replaced by Arthur Goldberg that there was a liberal majority on the court. And so when we think of the Warren Court with regard to controlling the police, it's in that window. Let me give you examples. 1966, Miranda versus Arizona, the famous Miranda warnings that police have to give when they question people. 1963, Gideon versus Wainwright, the requirement that state provide attorneys in state court to anyone who's facing a possible prison sentence. But even for the Warren Court, the story's more complicated because it was the Warren Court in 1968, the moment when the most liberal Supreme Court in history, where the court approved police engaging in stop and frisk without needing probable cause. And that did so much to contribute to racialized policing and racial profiling in the United States.
What were the forces that, what was the justification for something like that? I mean, how much of what was going on in society, like what were the forces, what was the rationale, and then maybe what was the impetus is the way I should ask that.
I discuss this in the book. I spent a lot of time researching and thinking about it. Why was it that the most liberal court in history gave the police such power? Earl Warren wrote the opinion. He was the author of Brown versus Board of Education. William Brennan, the liberal lion, was in the majority. Thurgood Marshall, the greatest civil rights lawyer in American history, was in the majority. It was an 8-1 decision with only Douglas dissenting. And I think you're absolutely right to look at what was going on in society at the time. The Warren Court decisions limiting the police were strongly criticized as handcuffing law enforcement. Miranda versus Arizona, for example, was lambasted by the police that would impede them being able to catch dangerous people. The exclusionary rule that said that evidence gained illegally by the police couldn't come into trial was said to leave guilty, dangerous people to go free. Terry versus Ohio was 1968. There was a time when there'd been riots in cities across the country, Newark, Detroit, Chicago, Los Angeles. Richard Nixon was running for president that year on a platform of law and order that he was going to appoint strict constructionists to the court. And I think all of those pressures led even the liberal Warren Court to empower the police.
I mean, that's really stunning because it also, I mean, everything that you're talking about, too, is highly racialized. Right? I mean, so there must have been, I mean, this was, there must have been an incredible awareness of how racialized that decision was. I mean, that's really, it's really stunning.
The NAACP Legal Defense Fund filed a brief in Terry versus Ohio saying allow the police to stop and frisk without probable cause will tremendously increase, legitimize race-based policing. Justice William Douglas in his dissent made this point. So it's not that it wasn't seen at the time. And yet all of the pressures of the moment led the Supreme Court to empower the police. Indeed, Terry versus Ohio itself involved two men who were walking up and down a public sidewalk, and they were observed by a police officer who thought they might be casing the joint. The two men were black, the police officer was white. The two men weren't doing anything but walking down a public sidewalk. Nothing illegal about that. But the Supreme Court allowed the officer to stop and frisk the men, said it didn't violate the Constitution.
And how long did that regime, I guess, last? I mean, it lasted quite a while.
Stop and frisk through today and into the future. It remains the law to this day that the police can stop somebody without needing probable cause, so long as there's a reasonable basis for suspicion, and can frisk the person so long as the police suspect somebody has a weapon. The reality of this is the police can now stop anybody virtually anytime they want, and all the officers just say, I saw a suspicious bulge, and that justified the frisk. And we know that the police use this power in a very racialized manner.
Just to be clear, there's a distinction between probable cause and reasonable suspicion.
Yes, probable cause is the language of the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution that says that searches and arrests are supposed to be based on probable cause. And the issue in Terry versus Ohio is, should the officer had to have probable cause that a crime was committed in order to stop and search these men? There wasn't probable cause. The Supreme Court said it's not necessary. The Supreme Court said a much more lenient standard is to be applied, reasonable suspicion, that hasn't been defined to this day. But that's still the standard. And it really is a standard that makes it easy for the police to stop anyone anytime they want and then frisk them.
How did they justify creating a sort of new standard that is subsidiary to the high bar that the Constitution states, A, and B, in New York, where we've had some judges push back on that? Is that because it was a state judge, or what was it? How are these limited?
I am very critical of the Supreme Court ignoring the language of the Constitution, probable cause, and then creating a much lesser standard. The Supreme Court did so explicitly to empower the police and make it easier for the police to combat crime. There was a lawsuit in New York that you're alluding to, Floyd versus City of New York, that challenged the way the NYPD was doing stop and frisk, saying that it was race-based. And they gathered statistics from over a decade, and I present these in the book, that show the tremendous disparity in stops for blacks and Latinos compared to whites relative to their population and holding everything else constant. It was clear that the federal district court judge was going to rule against the city, and the city decided to settle with the plaintiffs and agreed to end stop and frisk by the NYPD. What's important to note here is they ended stop and frisk in New York, and there was no increase in crime. We don't need to give the police that kind of tool in order to be able to have effective law enforcement.
Okay. And so following the Warren Court, we get the Burger Court, and things start to really, I guess, continue on that trajectory from stop and frisk. And it's a trajectory that remains today.
The Burger Court, the Rehnquist Court, the Roberts Court have all very much empowered rather than limited the police. You know, I said, and it might have sounded like hyperbole, the police can stop anyone at any time. Let me give you an example of a case. It's from the Rehnquist Court in 1996. It's a case called Wren versus United States. It involved a couple of men who were driving in Washington, D.C. Police car said it saw the men in their car stop an unusually long amount of time at the stop sign. They would stop 25 to 30 seconds. The officers on the base of that decided to follow the car. At one point, they saw the car turn without a turn signal. So they pulled over the car, ordered the driver and the passenger out of the car, searched the area of the car where they had been, and found illegal drugs. The stop for the traffic violation was obviously a pretext. In fact, in D.C., undercover officers aren't supposed to enforce traffic laws. Nonetheless, the Supreme Court said that it was permissible, that the evidence gained could be admitted in court. The Supreme Court said, once the police see a traffic violation, they can pull a car over, even if it's a pretext for wanting to do, say, a search for drugs. Well, if police follow any car for even a short amount of time, they'll observe a traffic violation. Somebody going a mile over the speed limit, turning without a turn signal, stopping at a stop sign but not quite long enough, driving what the officer regards as recklessly. Then the police can order the people out of the car and search that area of the car. That's why I say police can stop almost anyone anytime they want.
In 1983, there was also a ruling that essentially allowed for chokeholds. Tell us about that.
Of course, it's the chokeholds that killed George Floyd, Eric Garner, and so many others. The case you're referring to is City of Los Angeles versus Lyons. It involves a 24-year-old black man, Adolph Lyons, who was stopped by Los Angeles police officers late one night for having a burnt out taillight. Lyons was ordered out of his car. The officer slammed Lyons' hands above his head onto the roof of the car. Lyons complained that the keys he was holding were cutting into the skin of his palm. The officer thought that Lyons was, quote, mouthing off, so administered a chokehold on Lyons. Literally, the officer put his forearm around Lyons' neck and squeezed until Lyons was unconscious. He awoke. He had urinated and defecated. He was spitting blood and dirt. The officer gave him a traffic citation and allowed him to go. Lyons did some research and discovered at that point 16 people in Los Angeles had died from police use of the chokehold. Almost all like him, black men. Lyons sued the city for an injunction to stop police from using the chokehold, except if necessary, to protect the officer's life or safety. But the Supreme Court ruled that Lyons could not bring this suit. The Supreme Court said Lyons could not sue because he could not show that it was likely that he personally choked again in the future. Well, no one can prove that the police are likely to choke them in the future. So no one can sue to stop that kind of abusive police behavior. Had the Supreme Court come out differently, maybe George Floyd and Eric Garner wouldn't have died. Some cities have now outlawed police use of the chokehold. There was a bill that passed the House of Representatives to have the federal government do this, but that stalled in the Senate.
Let's talk about this, because this also will implicate, it seems to me, you certainly would know better than I, what's happening in Texas on some level, this principle of like, you can't, so he could only sue for redress on having been chokehold, but couldn't sue to prevent chokeholds in the future because he can't prove that he is harmed by the existence of the chokehold going forward.
That's exactly what the Supreme Court said. The court said, if someone wants to sue for an injunction, they have to show that they personally are going to be hurt in the future. So as an example, there were a couple of cases of police departments that had the practice of subjecting women to strip searches when they were stopped for routine traffic violations. Women who would be subjected to this degrading, horrific practice sued to stop the police from doing this to women. And the lower court said, based on the case I described to you, they can't show that they're going to be stripped again in the police. Therefore, they can't sue for an injunction.
That is a principle that remains, I guess. It must be applied across other.
It
you
does.
Can't.
You can only sue for an injunction if you can show it's likely to happen to you in the future. So there was a Supreme Court case 8 years ago that involved a federal law that allows the National Security Agency to intercept communications between people in the United States and certain designated foreign countries. The NSA can listen to the calls, read the email. And so a lawsuit was brought by some lawyers. They said, we have clients in these countries. We can't talk to them and protect the attorney-client privilege unless we now go see them. They had some journalists as part of the lawsuit, some business people. The Supreme Court ruled that the case had to be dismissed because none of the plaintiffs could show that their conversations were likely to be intercepted. The NSA doesn't tell people when it's going to intercept their communications.
So you can't have like a class action. I mean, you can't have we don't know which one of us 500,000 people who live in this city are going to be subjected to the chokehold, but we know one of us will, and that doesn't work.
That's not good enough. It's not good enough to say, we know that this large group will have some subjected to the practice. We just don't know which one. And no, it can't be a class action because the law says the named plaintiff in the class action must meet the requirements for standing. And of course, no named plaintiff can show that he or she is likely to be choked again in the future.
All right. So, I mean, this is the state where we are, and people can, I think, sort of surmise that the Supreme Court has, and but for a half of, let's say, the Warren Court, the Supreme Court has at least allowed, if not in some ways encouraged, the some of the worst excesses of policing in this country. But there is a remedy for all of this. And correct me if I'm wrong, which is this could be fixed by statute.
You're absolutely right. Congress by statute, state legislatures by statute, city councils by ordinance can fix what we're talking about. So we gave the example of the chokehold. The chokehold by police could be prohibited at any of these levels. All of these levels could adopt laws that say, for instance, that there can't be racial profiling and require police to record the race of everyone who they stop. All of these levels of government can impose restrictions on policing to stop other kinds of abuses that lead to death. So yes, there are alternatives to the Supreme Court that can bring about controls on the police.
All right. So with all that said, and I think, you know, it's a whole nother, I guess, a book, maybe not your book, to talk about the reluctance of our lawmakers to pass these curbs on the police in this country, but they can do it. And in many respects, I think they need to. But let's talk a little bit about what's happened over the past, well, really several years when it comes to the shadow docket. But let's talk specifically what's taken place this past week in Texas now. It is, as far as I know, impossible to get an abortion because all of the abortion clinics have shut down for fear of being subjected to, it wouldn't be just one lawsuit. I mean, if I understand this law correctly, there's an unlimited amount of lawsuits that could be levied at an abortion clinic or anybody who so-called abets an abortion for any single abortion, with a minimum of a $10,000 bounty and lawyer's fees. So if I am an abortion doctor and I perform an abortion, there is no limit to the number of plaintiffs who could sue me for that one abortion, if I understand correctly. And presumably there's no maximum amount of money that they could win as a, I don't know what to call it, just a bounty, right? Give me your perspective on this and how this is, you know, both the shadow docket, but also this so-called innovation that Texas came up with to not allow statutorily any state official to engage in this enforcement so as to provide there to be no, I guess, defendant in this case.
The Texas law prohibits abortions once the fetal heartbeat can be detected, which is about the 6th week of pregnancy. Roe versus Wade said that states can't prohibit abortion prior to viability, which is about the 23rd or 24th week of pregnancy. The Texas law is blatantly unconstitutional. Texas did not have this set up as a criminal law where its prosecutors would enforce it, or even a law where the state would bring civil suits. The reason is that if the state plays a role in enforcement, then its officers can be sued for an injunction to keep them from taking action. What Texas said is, we'll authorize civil suits, and then there's no one who can be sued to have the law declared unconstitutional. I think that's wrong, but at least it caused 5 Supreme Court justices to be unwilling to enjoin the Texas law, and it's gone into effect. In the shadow docket you refer to, it's just matters that come to the Supreme Court on an emergency basis. It's where somebody goes to the court, as here, to ask the court to issue an emergency injunction or to lift an injunction put in place by the lower court.
Let's just start with the governmental official who is enforcing or engaged in anything to do with enforcing that law. Aren't judges governmental officials?
But you can't sue a judge for even an injunction. The federal statute, 42 United States Code, section 1983, was amended to be explicit that judges cannot be sued for an injunction.
What about everybody who works at the courthouse, who presumably would have to do something to enforce to aid and abet this enforcement?
Unfortunately, the lower courts have said that just as judges have absolute immunity to suits for injunction, so does that extend to the court personnel. This is what's so insidious about the Texas law. It was set up intentionally to make it difficult to sue to stop it from going into effect. Now, I think it still could have been done and still could have been stopped. I think 4 justices said that on Wednesday night, but that's why Texas set it up the way that it did.
All right. Well, let me ask you this. What would be wrong with a New York State government that abridged the First Amendment? We don't like people wearing MAGA hats. Or the Second Amendment. Like, you see a gun, you can sue somebody who's holding a gun.
My example is, why can't Texas now prohibit same-sex marriage and say, we authorize civil suits against those who perform same-sex marriages? There's a right to same-sex marriage, just like there's a right to abortion. But why couldn't the state authorize civil suits? Or the other example is, why couldn't Texas now pass a law that says it's outlawed to criticize the governor of Texas and civil suits can be brought against those who do so?
I mean,
there's no stopping point to this principle. The state then can undermine any constitutional right by authorizing suits against those who exercise that right. Now, once somebody is sued for violating the law, if they're willing to take that chance, as a defense, they can argue that the law is unconstitutional. But you require a suit and then the defense to be brought. And if all the abortion clinics close up or if no one will perform a same-sex wedding, there's no one being sued and there's no one to try to argue then that the law is unconstitutional.
And we should be clear that it's not just risking $10,000, right? I mean, they are risking, they could get 1 million lawsuits against them. I mean, theoretically, in Texas, there's no limit to, and so, I mean, maybe somebody sets up an entity just for the sake of attempting to perform an abortion, I guess, and invite that lawsuit, and then we're bankrupt, and that's it. This seems like a really bad real world implications to all of this, aside from their ideological. I mean, I'm not put aside, like, they could reverse Roe v. Wade in a different context, right? And achieve the same goal. But they seem to be taking a wrecking ball to the entire judicial system if they okay this innovation.
Your answer, Roe v. Wade is still the law. It hasn't been overruled. But the Supreme Court allowed Texas to prohibit abortions after the 6th week of pregnancy. That can't be reconciled with the most basic tenets of what the rule of law is about. The Supreme Court could have, should have said, Texas can't prohibit abortions until and unless Roe v. Wade is overruled. And yet that's not what 5 justices of the court did. So at this moment, as we speak, Roe v. Wade is the law, but not effectively in Texas. Women in Texas don't have a right to abortion after the 6th week of pregnancy.
I mean, so then it's really just a question of semantics, isn't it? Because you're fundamentally undermining the rule of law such that it doesn't matter that there is a law, because it doesn't matter in Texas right now that Roe v. Wade is the law.
I wrote an op-ed that's in the Washington Post today, and that's exactly the point that I try to make.
It's a little disturbing.
It's more than a little bit disturbing. I think we should be outraged by it. Beyond abortion, as you say, if states can do this, they have an amazingly powerful tool to undermine all of our constitutional rights. And no state should be able to ignore the Constitution. Yet the Supreme Court here has very much approved Texas being able to do just that.
So you're a dean of law school. You know, this is the Supreme Court is the primary court on top of the sort of pyramid of courts, essentially, that protects the law of the land. Well, what happens if I structure a law, like I'm a lawmaker in New York State, and I take the Texas abortion law word for word, except for instead of aiding and abetting an abortion, it is aiding and abetting the purchase or the holding of a handgun, right? So I don't necessarily go after the person with the gun, but I go after everybody who sold it to them, anybody who drove them to the store, maybe, you know, whatever it is. And this heads up to the Supreme Court, and they say, oh, no, this isn't right. I mean, like at what point do you say as a dean of a law school, like, oops, this has sort of been a, you know, there's a little bit of a fiction that's involved in what I'm doing on some level that I can't even. Or, I mean, when does that happen?
It's already happened. It's a book that I wrote that we're talking about concerning the police. So the Supreme Court has failed to enforce the Constitution when it comes to policing. And I agree with you. If a state were to adopt a law allowing civil suits against those who have guns, the Supreme Court, same 5 justices, would declare it unconstitutional in a heartbeat. What's the difference? It's just that those 5 justices are very pro-gun rights and very against abortion rights. I mean, for years, Republican presidents have been picking justices who more than anything else are likely votes to overrule Roe versus Wade. We shouldn't be surprised now. With Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett, we have that court.
All right. I know you've got to get going in just a minute or two, but let me just ask you, you've written a piece that the California recall is, in fact, unconstitutional. Tell us that argument in the elevator pitch, I guess, version.
Sure. On September 14th, California voters will vote on 2 questions that are both on the same ballot. One is, should Gavin Newsom be recalled? Until the most recent polls, that was very close. And if he was going to lose, he was going to lose the 48 or 49% of the vote. If he is recalled, then on the second question, we vote who should replace him. And whoever gets the most votes becomes governor. In the most recent poll, the person who's leading has 18% of the vote. So if Newsom loses, what's going to happen is 48 or 49% of the people are going to want Newsom. And 18% are going to want the person who gets the most votes on the second question. but that's the person who's become governor. To have somebody with 18% become governor when the majority, or at least 48 or 49%, want somebody else is nonsensical, anti-democratic, and unconstitutional.
And we should say, and Newsom's not allowed to be on that second question of the ballot. I mean,
that's correct.
And so what makes it I know you got to get going, but the unconstitutionality is that the votes of the people who voted to keep Gavin Newsom in office have less value than the 18% who vote for Larry Elder.
I apologize for the phone ringing and that I didn't know where to stop it, but you're exactly right. And that was the point that Aaron Adlin and I were trying to make in the op-ed piece.
Well, I can't thank you enough for joining us today. The book is I got it right here. Forgive me.
I can tell you.
Oh, wait, I have it. Sorry. It is. Please allow me. Presumed Guilty: How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights. Erwin Chemerinsky. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Well, that's it for us today, ladies and gentlemen. We will be back tomorrow. For those of you who celebrate Rosh Hashanah, Happy New Year. For those of you who don't, it's just Happy Tuesday. And we'll be back live tomorrow, Wednesday, and then Thursday and Friday. So get ready. We will see you then. Thanks.